Accession number 18202, Reel 4.
As far as Reel 4. The P-47, the Thunderbolt, as I said, was a very large airplane and quite fast, a good deal faster than the other type of aircraft we had there, which was the Spitfire Mark V. There were a few Mark 9s for the armament training, but largely Mark 5s, and therefore a bit ancient, because after all, we're now in 1945.
44?
I beg your pardon. No. We went up to the Middle East after we got our wings in 1945, and the war in Europe was fast drawing to a close, you see. But, of course, there was still a lot going on in the Far East. And, anyway, to resume the two aircraft we had, there was the P-47, the Thunderbolt, and the Spitfire. And, much to my delight, I was allocated to the Spitfire, because, of course, this was an airplane which was the very stuff of legend in the Royal Air Force, and rightly so, because it was a magnificent airplane. In most ways, and I perhaps come back to that in a little while. But anyway, the Thunderbolts were okay, but the Spitfire, of course, could outmaneuver them whenever it felt like it, unless the Thunderbolt just charged away when it could pull away from us, or dived or climbed faster than the old Spit Mark V. Now, this was very interesting, actually, because here we were at the operational training unit and we were expected to fly. You see, at this stage, I didn't mention, by the way, that at our service flying training school, we did all our flying on the North American AT-6 air training number 6, popularly known as the Harvard. It's a twin tandem twin seat aircraft with a Pratt & Whitney Wasp of about 600 horsepower, which was a lot more powerful than anything we'd flown before in Tiger Moths. Then when we got to OTU, we were then put on these flights where there were these two types of aircraft, both of which had a single cockpit. Now, the rub was, having done all our flying previously in dual-seat aircraft, they could afford to get us used to the thing with a nice qualified instructor sitting at the back. When we got to FIDE and got on to Spitfires and Thunderbolts, there was only one cockpit. So what they did, as they'd done with so many other people in flying in the Air Force, they gave us a pamphlet, a little booklet called Pilot's Notes. In my case, it referred to the Spitfire, which you read up as avidly as you could, remembered as much as you could. You had a chat, if you were lucky, with one or two of the instructors who perhaps gave you a little warning about funny things that Spitfires did when they were on the ground still and when they got into the air. And then they said, right, now, here you go. You're on your way. You've done all this flying on Harvards. You're now a qualified pilot. You climb into the Spitfire and just take it off. Well, of course, there was a great deal of apprehension because we'd never done anything like this before. And the Spitfire, as I remember, let me see if I've got it right, the Mark V, in fact, right up to the 9s and beyond a bit, had the Merlin engine, which the corkscrew of air that the propeller sent round the aircraft came up against keel surfaces and therefore increased the swing of the aircraft on takeoff. And until you were reasonably experienced, that aircraft could swing fairly violently, as I remember it, to the left. Later on, when they had the more powerful Griffin engines, the prop went round the other way and it swung to the right. But you had to be very careful, therefore, because you never felt anything like this. You were told about it, and you thought, well, you knew enough, you'd trim full right rudder, and you keep right rudder on, so keep the thing straight and not swing on takeoff. But I think everyone swung. Now, at the end of that course, they had a little debriefing, and some cunning sort of flight commander had a note of everyone's mistakes on their first flight in Spitfire or Thunderbolt. And everyone had a penalty to pay, you know, a fine to pay. So-and-so did this, so-and-so did that. When it got to me, he said, I don't think there's anything down here about you. Oh, yes, he said, I remember, and I had to admit it. It had just swung sufficiently left to kiss the sand as we left the ground. If it had been any earlier, I'd have been bogged down in the sand off the runway. But he'd remembered this, and so I had a fine to pay too. But as soon as we'd done that first flight, it was okay, because, you know, we were then... we knew what to expect, and the Spitty, of course, which was quite a tricky little aircraft, really, particularly on the ground... we were used to it. And in this respect, I did have a little story I used to tell some years ago. In fact, I dined out on it once or twice about the Spit, because she was so well liked and she was so gentle and light to handle and manoeuvrable that they used to call her the Lady of the Air. And I thought, well, yes, that's all very well when she's in the air. But due to the fact that when you're on the ground, due to the way the undercarriage folds outwards and up into the wings, it means that the track of the undercarriage is very narrow, and this can therefore give you some nasty swings, and if you do start swinging, puts a lot of pressure on the undercarriage. And in addition to that, you've got, according to different marks, anything up to 12 or 13 feet of engine and nose in front of you, usually very well oil-streaked. And once your tail is down in the landing position, you have to look out each side, and then when you're taxiing, you also have to swing the nose about so you can see ahead, otherwise it's just a massive, great nose in front of you. And this, combined with this narrow undercarriage, used to make it quite tricky to handle when it was on the deck. And on this particular occasion, I used to hear them say, the Lady of the Air. And I said, yes, she may be a Lady of the Air, but she's a right whore when she's on the ground. And I said this without thinking, and it was very well received. As I say, I used it a couple of times after that and managed to dine out of it. But... she was a good aeroplane, and yet, here I'm sort of talking about something I don't know anything about. I never flew a Hurricane, but many of my friends did, including that fellow up there, and it was a tremendous, it was a better aircraft from the point of view of stability, a nice wide undercarriage. It was a much better gun platform than the Spitfire. She would hold steady, very far better than the Spit, which used to sort of buck a bit, especially when cannons were fired and things like this. But apart from that, the Spitfire was so manoeuvrable that is why, certainly as far as I was concerned, it was the aircraft. You know, it wouldn't do anything out of the way. It was quite difficult to stall the Spitfire and get it into a spin. You had to spin a service aircraft before you were allowed to be properly qualified on it. You had to know, you had to get it into a spin and get it out of a spin, because these are one of the dangerous things that can happen. But the old Spitfire, or young Spitfire, was very difficult to stall. When she did stall, she tended to spin a bit flat. But if you knew what you were doing, you never got into a spin, because the whole thing used to sort of judder and give you so much warning of this spin that you just didn't get into it. And you therefore use this in manoeuvring. You take it to the limit in manoeuvring. There's a tale I could tell there about a certain wing commander in Italy. This was after the war. But anyway, I'm digressing there. I last mentioned going on to the Spitfire and doing the first flip in it in this one cockpit aircraft, and got over that safely. And then we went... during this time at SFTS, we were also being trained hard on the ground for the Far East. And the plan was to take us over on carriers to the Malayan coast. And we would be catapulted off the carriers, or assisted off the carriers, and then follow the troops, the army, up Malaya as they took it back from the Japs. And they would make landing strips, and we would land on those strips, rearm, refuel, and support the troops further as we went up. This was the plan. It never came to fruition because, of course, they dropped the atom bomb. But we did all this training, and one of the things I remember was they had, I forget what it was called, it was some sort of survival suit. How the blazes we would have existed or survived in Malayan jungle if we'd come down in these things, and the boots we had to guard against snakes and poison things and all sorts of things, and the stuff that we were carrying, hatchets and everything else. Well, you know, if we didn't sort of die through the weight and the heat, we would have just died through loss of fluid and perspiration. But fortunately, we never had to put it into practice. But I can remember very well, we had lots and lots of lectures, and we were told all about survival in the jungle and everything else. It was very interesting, but fortunately it didn't come about. And so, we finished our OTU at FIDE, and the next thing we knew, it was VE Day. And I know at FIDE there, we must have had about a week's continuous, partying. You would go from one place to another, and you'd be greeted with drinks. And it was all on the station, so it was all, you know, our own people. But no one bothered for a week, and then discipline had to come back after that. Next thing I knew was I was posted, I was made redundant. They didn't want any more aircrew anymore. They were trying to get rid of them then. That included the Far East. And I was sent down as a redundant aircrew member, went back down to Kenya, posted to Eastleigh, which was the pre-war air station, and as far as I know, it's still stationed there, but I could be wrong now.
In Hampshire?
No, this is Eastleigh in Kenya, RAF Eastleigh, just near Nairobi. And that was a beautiful station, pre-war, you know, all the messes and things were built with beautiful granite and hardwood oak. Magnificent places. And the storm drains alongside the roads must have been a good 6 or 7 feet deep and about 12 feet across, because in the rainy season, you know, there can be an awful lot of water about. I remember on two occasions seeing chaps who ran trucks and things into these storm drains, and one of them was a very serious matter. There was a couple of chaps killed. On that station too, there were lots of prisoners of war from the Eritrean campaign, Italian prisoners of war, and so they'd been there quite a number of years. And they were perfectly happy. They had their own camp at the top of Eastleigh there. They supplied all the barbers. In my redundant role, I was given charge of the freight section because the first inklings of commercialism were coming in and people were wanting to fly things to East Africa. And the Air Force decided that they would be charged, and if they sent any freight out, they would have to pay then. And I was given this job of running this freight store and levying the charges and having all the bills of lading and whatever they were called, air freight bills, made out. And to do this, I was given an askari corporal, askari being the Swahili for soldier, askari corporal, and I think it was five askaris. And in addition to that, I had a Seychellese chap. They're very handsome people, you know, the Seychellese. They have the sort of ready bronze complexion, but quite aquiline features. I forget his name now. He was very tall, very good looking, a wow with the girls, including the WAFs, who say, as far as I could see. And he could also speak the Swahili. Whether he picked it up in East Africa or not, I don't know. But I spoke a little Swahili, but not enough for conversation. But I did learn quite a few words because I was down there for about 11 months or more, I think. But during this time, it was very interesting because we did all sorts of nice things. We used to go and visit people and or against invitations, and we'd go up country. And I was once approached by a fellow that he said, "I'm going to buy a tiger moth from someone. Can you fly it up for me to Nakuru?" I think it was, or something. And I said, "Yes." He said, "There'll be £100 in it for you." And I said, "Great." And the day before I was due to fly this thing up, I was posted away from Kenya back to the MED, Central Mediterranean Forces. But anyway, to go back, very interesting in many ways in Kenya, because in addition to this freight thing, I found myself, I sort of little godlike qualities or capabilities, because when I went down to the freight store each morning after a leisurely breakfast, I might say, there would be the askaris on parade and the corporal, and they were all beautifully done out, as so many of these indigenous troops are, in khaki, which obviously laundered every day, maybe twice a day, I don't know. But of course they never do the same things to their bodies, but that's right. But there they were, and this corporal would pull his askaris up to the alert, and they would present arms to me, which was very unofficial, because you don't present arms to senior NCOs, which I still was at that time. But the Seychellese fellow used to laugh his head off at this. But I decided not to stop it, because these askaris wanted to do it. This was their life. I remember on one occasion, some oaf of a fellow sort of called out to my askari corporal, boy, come here, you see. He was commissioned, this chap. So the askari corporal walked over, stood smartly to attention, and said, "Sir, me no boy, me askari." And that summed the whole thing up. You know, this was their proud position in the community. They were soldiers, you see. And I learned a lot from that. Anyway, what was I going to say? Yes, there were one or two things. Oh, yes, I remember. Perhaps I shouldn't say this in view of your warning earlier, but no names, no pack drill. I was approached during my stay there. I was asked by a chap, a civilian employee, whose name I can't tell you, and I forget it anyway, who was in an official position, customs and excise. And at this stage, they were looking at everything coming in and out of Kenya. And he said to me, "Is it possible to get a small supply of 9mm ammunition?" And I said, "Well, what the blazes do you want it for?" And he said, well, we live out of town, out of Nairobi. When I'm on duty here at the aerodrome, my wife's alone with a couple of houseboys and one or two servants. And he said, there's a lot of scare feeling amongst the general populace, you know, the African people, Kenyans. And he said, I'm very worried, and I have a pistol which will take 9mm ammunition, or it will take it. And he said, I want to leave her this, and I want to leave ammunition with it, because it might save her life. And you could see the point. Well, I didn't think I'd get hold of this, but I chatted up a certain gentleman who was in a position to supply it, and I got him a box of this 9mm ammunition. Thereafter, as a little quid pro quo, none of our aircraft on the East African communications flight were ever properly searched when they landed at Kenya. And it's very amusing, really. But, again, in retrospect, a few years later, this, of course, had been the start, as I then realised later on, of the Mau Mau business. You see, they didn't call it Mau Mau then, and there wasn't wholesale murdering going on, but it had already started, and this fellow knew it, and he was concerned about the safety of his wife. And so in many ways, I think I probably did the man a good turn. He was certainly responsible enough not to misuse the ammunition. But it was, of course, against the rules. And that was one of the interesting things that happened. We used to go... we had, besides the comm flight at Eastleigh, we had, I think it was 249 Squadron. They had a... they were equipped with these American Baltimore. They were light bombers. And that was very interesting. I had the odd flight in those. And we used to do quite a bit of, I suppose it was amateur photography, really. And somewhere in the house I've got quite a lot of black and white photographs taken from these Baltimores of game in the reserves. There's a couple there, tremendous shots of the Longonot crater. That's an extinct volcanic crater in Kenya. And Mount Kilimanjaro, tremendous sort of that. And they also had, I think they called them white rhino. They were very, very scarce things which used to roam around. I think that was near Kilimanjaro. I'm not sure now. I'd have to look it up. But we used to photograph these from the air. But they were very jealously guarded, these particular white rhino. But some of the game shots I've got, even though I say it myself, are very, very good. And it's a pity they couldn't have been in colour. But, you know, giraffes, and there's one photograph I've got there. And I forget the number that I counted originally, but there must have been, dozen, probably 15 giraffe in this photograph. When the thing was developed, it was sharp and good photograph, and unless you really knew where to look, you could only see three or four of these giraffe. They were so camouflaged against the thorn trees and things like this. Most interesting. And that was that. And then eventually, one morning, the adjutant, people in the ordinary room, said, the adjutant wants to see you. And I went along, and he said, would you like to go back on flying? And I said, just try me. And he said, well, they're getting a bit short of pilots up in the Central Mediterranean Forces area. And I subsequently found that there were just three wings. There are three squadrons on each wing. And there were these three squadrons, one of Mustangs and two of Spitfires, in Italy and Austria. And this would have been in about April, May 1946. because I'd had a year in, or the best part of a year in Kenya, and they flew me up to the Middle East again, and at Ishmaelair, that's another of the canal zone stations, I did just about 6 hours, I think, refresher flying in Harvard's, although I didn't need the instructor, I'm glad to say. And but no spit flying until I got actually up to a place called Treviso, which is in north Italy, just north of Venice. And there I joined 253 Squadron, interviewed by the CO, squadron leader, forget his initials, Graves, rather nice name for a squadron leader, CO, popularly known as Gravy. And he interviewed me and said, "Welcome to the squadron." He said, "There's no war on now." He said, "And therefore I take a very dim view of anyone who bends any of my aircraft. Don't let it happen to you." So that was that. But eventually, fortunately, when he'd left the squadron, I did bend one of their aircraft. And that was, it was in Italy. And just before I was due to go back up to Austria, we'd been up to Austria, flying from Zelpfig, and then moved back to Italy. And when we moved back to Italy, well, it was a stream landing, and my wingtip caught a farmhouse off the end of the runway, and it was quite a good prang. I had about 5 or 6 days in hospital, 4 of them unconscious, and at the end of that time, I made it very clear that I was due back in Austria to get married, and they better do something about it. And so I then hitched back up to Austria. I couldn't get a flight, and that's where I married Hermie. But in the meantime, we had the three wings in North Italy there. One was at Udine, which was near Trieste. Ours was at Treviso. We were 244 wing, and we were 87 squadron. 87 squadron, oh Lord. Ours 253. And, 92 Squadron. That's the famous East India Squadron. 253, our squadron, by the way, is the Hyderabad State Squadron. And every Christmas, even when I got there, you would get 100 Churchman number one from the Nizam of Hyderabad. Everyone, including the Oaks, you know. And he was very good. He'd endowed this 253 squadron. There were other squadrons which also bore Hyderabad State, but I'm not sure who they were, but I think there were one or two others, because after all, he was supposed to have been at one time the richest man in the world. And incidentally, that crest up there is the squadron crest, and it's a sort of Indian warrior mailed fist with a sort of battle axe in it. So, what happened then? I don't know, I was coming to the end of my career there. Married Hermie in Austria after this prang. Took her up to Vienna, got her a passport.
How did you come to meet your wife?
Well, she'd never been invited to the dances that the